It's been wonderfully engaging and exhausting in a really great way. I love the way people have been, on one hand, very aggressive with interesting ideas and also open and curious about other people's ideas. I've learned a lot at this meeting, and we figured the best way to sort of do the panel was to do more of that. So we've actually together planned the panel discussion where the panelists ask questions of the audience. And part of the spirit of that is that, and another thing we love about science is how young people come in and rethink and question what the older people are doing, and so we chose some of the younger members of our community to bring that kind of perspective and sort of ask the questions they want to ask to sort of really press us to make sense of what we're trying to do. The other feature of this panel discussion is that these are big questions we're wrestling with, and it's clear we haven't focused on an answer. We're grappling with big things. And as we were planning the panel discussion, we were really curious what people were thinking who haven't spoken up and asked questions at the meeting. And we thought it would be really interesting if any of you felt like joining in. So what we're going to have is we're going to go across the panel. Each one is going to ask their question, and they will, in the first instance, if they wish, single out an individual at the meeting they want to ask the question, and then we'll have some further discussion among the group. And as then when we reach the end, there'll be a special opportunity for anyone who's not asked any questions at the meeting, who wants to maybe do something similar, ask an individual, or put a question to the meeting. You know, why are you thinking this way? How are you ever going to make progress? Whatever these kinds of questions are, you may have. That would be good. The last comment is I've also urged our panelists to remember this is a group of high integrity, and you should push the tough questions. Don't be nice to your senior colleagues. Ask questions you really want to ask, and I promise them you guys could take it. So yes, that's the other. And just to help us feel free to really engage and have open discussion. This is not recorded, and you'll be. So since I'm behind the podium, that's what it means. It's not official. So all smartphones must be turned off. Okay. So we will start with Laura.
There are a few questions under the same theme, which is the multiverse, shifting the framework of thinking into having many universes rather than one. So one of the questions is, what role does gravity or will gravity play in answering some of the pressing questions, the fundamental questions, when, for example, when it comes to inflation or entropy of the universe and time serial? Following further in the issue of time, what is the relation between time and the laws of physics? Andy has done some beautiful work on that, especially when we think of applying quantum mechanics, and there is an uncertainty principle that goes with it. In everything we have addressed so far is either why did we start with high energies, or why do we have an era of time, and basically questions related to the very early universe or to the future evolution of the universe. But ultimately, in all of them, we use a set of laws and equations to address those questions. On the other hand, those equations are not immune to the very questions we are asking. They are related to the clocks we use and the energies we are talking about. So gravity, time, and the laws of physics.
Sorry.
Okay, don't. That's for you.
Well, I don't know what that means.
How many people think time is emergent?
Paul.
I would say I think we're a little bit much more pragmatic. We might be much more pragmatic. At least the central issue before us is what happened with the event. That is a gravity question. It's a final gravity question. And, you know, it could be anything from an emergence of space and time or beginning of some sort to a bounce. That crucially divides the realm of possibility of cosmological mystery.
But the part where I get stuck with that is that if we are using quantum mechanics equations to explore what happened at the Big Bang, there is an uncertainty principle built in into the clocks we are using to measure time and estimate entropy. So I don't know if those questions even make sense at that stage. Absolutely, and in fact, I mean, to try and be provocative as well, we are still doing Boltzmann distribution equation. There is no way that general relativity is included in the distribution function. Boltzmann didn't study just equilibrium. He also studied an out-of-equilibrium system through the H function. And to this day, we still use the numbers you use today, 10 to minus 120, that comes from the Boltzmann calculation. Gravity doesn't figure out anywhere in that estimate. So although we recognize that we need it, we are still not including it. We don't know how to include it. We are still using the same equation, Boltzmann equation.
Thank you. question is, can Kolmogorova uptunneling happen, or can Guthari uptunneling happen? Those are two very different questions.
By happen, you mean theoretically. Repeat the question.
So the first question is, put your hand up if you think that Guthari uptunneling can happen. Is that right? That's the question.
Fans. Okay, what about Coleman DeLucia uptunneling? Does that make more sense?
That's two questions. Okay, well, any, no, did you want to follow up on that? Or you happy? And any, before we finish resolving the question of gravity, any other comments? Yeah, I think I'll I think that's getting a little technical for you. Every now and then someone sneaks a little quantum or a crunch or something, or argues there should be more crunches, but it's been very, very classical. A lot of the conversation has been very classical.
Can I take two votes and then vote?
Two votes and you're done, and we'll go over to Ben.
So how many people would vote yes that quantum mechanics is valid and survives beyond high energy, Big Bang scales? And the second...
I'm not good at counting, so I'm not
the majority. And the second question is, how many people think time is fundamental rather than emergent? Thank you. That again is
Stephen's calling him too. So Ben, go.
In both cases, the majority was
there's
yes.
There's no calling votes. So sorry, guys. You can't.
Was there one more comment about this topic, or?
Did you have a comment? You put your hand up.
No. That was just an enthusiastic vote. Okay. Well, the first question I wanted to ask is the least controversial one that I wanted to ask, which relates to what Stefan was saying. The things we're discussing here have to do with the UV completion of the theory. All right. They have to do with how to resolve the singularity, which is a UV question. Is there a bounce there? They have to do with the theory of initial conditions, and they have to do with whether how to regulate the infinities of eternal inflation. And one person who's been very shy during this conference is Rob Myers. And you know, we have what we think is a UV completion, which is string theory. But 99% of string theorists are not thinking about these questions. I don't know, they're doing supersymmetric things. And you know, Tom and Willie are some exceptions. People are trying to really come up with a fundamental theory. So I have really two questions for you. One is, do you see a direction for some technical progress there, putting some of these cosmological questions on firmer theoretical ground? And also, what would it take to get mainstream string theorists to think about these questions? That's why you're not doing cosmology these days.
Yeah.
this?
Well, I think
yes,
is,
you can by putting the wave function of the universe on the landscape.
I think one example of that, Neil. I think one example of that, Neil, is the construction by Paul Steinhardt and Juan Maldacena, Liam McAllister, and some other Princeton people. It's our best understanding of any vacuum in string theory. So are you asking for a non-perturbative description of those vacua, or what is your issue?
If there's one thing we know... If there's one thing we know about string theory, Neil, it's that it reduces to Einstein gravity at low energies. And Einstein gravity contains cosmologies. So
I'm going to bring it to another question, another comment.
So I'm sorry, I know a few things about string theory, but what I understand is the way in which the vehicle thickness is achieved is to assume that there is a fundamental scale and a fundamental scale. But this is a good by hand. So is it?
I would say definitely not. This is a miracle string theory that a lot of things you put in a quantum field like anode,
We've heard a lot about the Penrose, I think it's now called the Penrose problem, questions of phase-space conservation and the canonical measure. And I think these are reasonably compelling, that inflation, non-eternal inflation at any rate, cannot explain the arrow of time and the low-entropy initial conditions. So I guess I've got sort of two questions aimed at two different responses people have taken to this. The first question is to those such as, I think, Neil, who thinks this is a killer argument against inflation, non-eternal inflation, is why do you think that our theory of the generation of primordial perturbations must also be a theory that also solves the initial condition question when you don't apply the same... you don't also demand it of our theory of the generation of Big Bang nucleosynthesis or any other theory you have in nature. And my second half of my question is to those who take the sort of other approach, which is to say that, in fact, eternal inflation does answer the arrow of time problem, is to ask people sort of what the status of that is. And maybe Alan is a proponent of that view. Is the status of that an aspiration? Is the status of that... How sort of complete is that story? And perhaps to make it a bit sharper, to ask, do you think there are a finite number of degrees of freedom inside a de Sitter horizon? And do you think that if a de Sitter, given de Sitter patch, gives rise to a huge number of de Sitter patches, that there are the same number of degrees of freedom in the final de Sitter patches as there were in the initial de Sitter patch? And if you answer yes to both those questions, how do you reconcile that with believing it solves the arrow of time problem? So I guess in the first instance, I want to direct those questions respectively to Neil and to Alan, and then to sort of open them up to everybody else.
Yeah, sure. So the point I was trying to make is that the point I was trying to make is that the perturbations in the background geometry come together. They're part of one geometry. The only reason we treat them as separate is technical convenience. And so to me, it makes no sense to use the canonical measure for the perturbations and just ignore this for the background. And that's precisely what's done with, say, approaches to chaotic inflation. I'm not talking about eternal, non-eternal inflation. You just throw the background where you feel is plausible. So now I understand why people did that, because there's nothing better to do. Okay, but that surely the question that should have been asked and should be asked now is, how do I define this theory in such a way that there is a well-defined, you know, probability for each particular background with its fluctuations? So I think the whole field has been sort of schizophrenic in this respect. And it's time to focus far more on the foundations for defining probabilities in theories including gravity, which have the fact that Hamiltonian is zero, so you can't do conventional statistical mechanics. And, you know, maybe even in the context of what I was doing, you know, you can do something relatively half-baked, which is to say, assume the perturbations are in their ground state, but the background, you know, is defined some other way. I mean, you to get something semi-realistic, you would have to do that. I mean, I agree with what Sean was saying, that if you allow arbitrary inhomogeneities and you trace them back, you just get a disaster. But I think you can impose constraints at the initial time and other constraints at the final time. And the question is, what kind of constraints do you need to impose in order to be talking about a well-defined theory? And as far as I can tell, in my trivially simple example, it's totally classical, you immediately see that the question you were trying to ask is just completely ill-defined. So, and that was the point of my talk, really.
Well, actually, I'm glad to hear that the point of your talk was that things are undefined, because when you gave the talk, it made it sound like the point of the talk was that inflation was highly improbable. I think it's just undefined in the context of the model you discussed. But
just Yeah, so I think what I was trying to do was to, so first make the point it's undefined. Secondly, make what seems to be the most plausible way to make it well-defined, given that I have some notion I want to sum over generic states. You know, the whole point of inflation is you take a generic state and it ends up with a universe like ours. So I wanted to take an objective point of view, just look at this theory, what is the most, you know, the simplest way in which I can construct a well-defined ensemble. And that's what I did. And then the outcome is completely wrong. I'm not advocating that. I'm just saying, you know, you can do this and you get completely the wrong answer. So that I hope it was just a challenge to inflationists to do something at least as good, which gives the right answer. And I don't see anything in prospect in that respect. So it's really just a challenge, and the title was Challenges.
Okay, fair enough. In terms of answering Adam's questions, I guess I might just say, which I think is a correct historical fact, that in terms of single-shot inflation, I never supported Davies' claim that inflation solved the arrow of time problem. With single-shot inflation, I think there's no way of even understanding exactly what the arrow of time question means, because one doesn't know what initial conditions to start with. So with single-shot inflation, I think one inevitably needs some kinds of a theory of initial conditions. I think inflation makes the theory of initial conditions much easier to imagine because the initial conditions that you need are much, much less fine-tuned. But I think clearly one needs some kind of a theory of initial conditions with single-shot inflation. And even with eternal inflation, one still needs some answer to the question of how did the whole thing start. I do have this hope that I've expressed several times in this conference, and part of Adam's question is what's the status of that? I think the word aspiration is probably not the right word. It's a hope that when we do understand the fundamental laws of physics and the phase space or quantum Hilbert space on which it all operates, I think it does seem plausible to me. It's easier to think classically than quantum mechanically, but I think there's a correspondence that the real laws of physics can be described by an infinite phase space or an infinite quantum Hilbert space. And if that's the case, then it could very likely also be the case that if you start with any normalizable initial state, and as far as I can tell, only normalizable initial states make any sense at all, so I don't think that's a restriction, even if you have an infinite Hilbert space or an infinite phase space. I think it is conceivable that the situation could be that you could start with any normalizable state, and if you evolve it from there to the future, it will start to spread, entropy will grow. If you evolve from there to the past, it will also start to spread from wherever you start out with. And entropy will go backwards in the past. So in both of these asymptotic regions, one would have entropy monotonically changing with time, which is a solution to the arrow of time problem. So I think I see a hope there for the solution to the arrow of time problem. I certainly am not going to claim it's solved. I don't really see any other mechanism for really solving the arrow of time problem, except by finding some law of physics which determines an initial unique state, which may, I'll leave that open as certainly a possibility as well. But I think I'd say the only purely dynamical solution I can see is this picture that might happen in an infinite phase space. I'll stop there.
Well, sorry, if I could interrupt. I think Adam asked, I'm sympathetic to your point of view. I think Adam asked some painful questions, though, that I don't think you've quite... Could you remind him of your painful questions?
Yeah, I should try that.
Do you think that there is a finite number of degrees of freedom in a De Sitter patch? And do you think if that patch gives rise to a great many patches down the road, there is the same number of degrees of freedom in those final patches taken together as there was in the initial patch?
Right. Okay.
And how does that comport with your claims about infinity and the infinite nature of phase space?
Right. Okay, I'm not sure I know the answers to those questions. I take some solace in the fact that string theories do seem to predict that there should be Minkowski vacuum that you can decay to. So this idea of an eternally De Sitter system where the vacuum energy stays positive for all times, you know, may not be part of any
but
realistic
presumably
theory.
Presumably there's no Minkowski vacua in our past, which, so it's hard to see how that's going to explain the arrow of time using some future decay to Minkowski.
Well, There certainly can be Minkowski regions in our past light cone. No, they don't. Our past light cone is big. What?
You mean through the other end of the De Sitter throat, on the other end?
Yeah.
They have to contain something.
I think this is a somewhat subtle question. I think they can be there to some extent, but.
Yeah. Okay. Anyway, I'm not sure if I know what the answer to this question is, but I guess I would, to be honest, I never fully understood holography, so I'll just admit that to start with. And in my own mental picture, which may be totally wrong, I don't know, when you start to follow a De Sitter space and it breaks up into different regions, which might tunnel and so on, I would think of the global entropy of that system and the global number of degrees of freedom to be large and much larger than what was in the original De Sitter patch. So I think probably to make my point of view turn out to actually be the truth, which I'll admit is not necessarily going to be the case, one has to believe that even when you're describing a single De Sitter patch, that you have to believe that somehow the theory itself has an arbitrary large number of degrees of freedom, and that when one talks about the De Sitter entropy, one is really just saying that only a finite number of those degrees of freedom are excited, and others can be excited later. So that's my hope of how it might play out.
Ellen, I have a question for that. When it comes to the De Sitter space, it's globally defined at future infinity. So however we mess up future infinity, we will know about it at the present time. So if we break the entropy bound of the De Sitter space at future infinity, isn't that, that's the question I asked to Sean as well before, isn't that the same as mining energy out of the De Sitter space? I mean, I can think of a setup with a box on a rope, send it to infinity and then pull it back, and I'm collecting energy out of it. Because sending the entropy to infinity is equivalent to sending the vacuum energy to zero.
Not sure if I understand the question, really. Maybe, if a desert space starts to tunnel, or I think even if it doesn't, as time goes on, it gets bigger and bigger if you look, say, at a closed universe slicing. Mm-hmm. Certainly one observer in that De Sitter space will never see more entropy than the standard bound. I believe that. But if you permit yourself to talk about some global definition of entropy, which is not what's seen by any one observer, mm-hmm. and if that makes sense, which it may or may not, I don't really claim to understand it, then I think that can exceed the De Sitter bound and would be expected to exceed the De Sitter bound if you calculate it that way. And I don't see how to mine anything from it.
Every time we change the entropy, we are doing something to the energy. There is a work done to change the entropy. Tom?
Since we have Alan on the hot seat. I wanted to ask a question, because this picture about a phase space in which all trajectories run off to infinity. So if that really is the picture of our universe, the space of possibilities for our universe, where are we in that picture? Are we at a finite radius or are in phase space? Are we really at infinity in that phase space? And that's crucial, because as soon as you say we're at a finite radius of in that phase space, I think all your arguments about attractors disappear, because I would just put my phase space density somewhere which avoids us, and then the answers depend on initial
We're at an arbitrarily large location.
What?
Arbitrarily late time.
No, we must be at infinity in that phase
arbitrarily
space.
Arbitrarily.
We must be. We must actually be at infinity. If you put us at any finite location in that phase space, then the argument about the attractor goes away. Well, we're getting into order of limits issues, which are pretty, I think it's very dangerous. But I'd just like to, there's a simple question. You draw your phase space, are we at infinity in that picture of phase space?
Yeah, no, I don't think there is anything at infinity. I think in any space, it's only the finite points that are defined. You can take limits as things go to infinity, but... Yeah, but we're one of many, many bubbles. So those things don't even define the full system. Don't come close to defining the full system that I have in mind. But those things are defined, so they would have values. Yeah. Okay, let me say it slightly differently. I would say that you could start with any normalizable distribution. And again, I'm pressing, it sounds like I'm expressing a fact, I'm expressing a hope. but you can start with any normalizable distribution. It will normally be some mess, which won't have any living things in it. You let it evolve for a long time. It will, entropy will start to grow. We'll just consider the future. The past is just identical, t to minus t. So you follow it to the future. Entropy will start to grow. I claim that if the underlying laws of physics allow inflation, that will form an attractor. It will be a natural thing that things will be approaching as they fan outward. And then life will form in these regions that inflate. Maybe some small amount of life will form in other regions, but I expect not much. And when you're all done, almost all complex systems will be in regions that inflated. I don't see anything that prevents that. Well, I think any normalizable distribution does have some scale, because every expectation value has to be. Well, that in itself is that is a normalizable distribution, I believe. If your ensemble converges. I think any normalizable distribution does have a scale. You can calculate the expectation value of the sum of p squared plus q squared, or summed over all i's. Than where we are now. Yes, that's right. That's right. What's there to justify? Well, you could, and then life would form much later. But for every choice you make, no, it will.
Sort of implicit in your question is that, well, we're playing by the rules of quantum mechanics because that's where the finiteness of the entropy comes from, and also that we're playing with the global picture, which is, you know, where we get these multiple horizon size regions from. So just absolutely. Within that context, yeah. Then, you know, the comment I'd like to make is that even though the total state can be, let's say, only in a finite number of different states, that doesn't mean that in any meaningful way late time subsystems have to have small or even, you know, finite entropy. So suppose, you know, at a very late time, I can trace out a very large amount of the system and still have a very large amount of system remaining, and there's no bound that I know of that you can put on that system. So I don't think that we should say that very many horizon size regions have to have an entropy which is bounded by S to Sitter.
Can I just make a comment? So in that picture, I mean, this is all assuming we can take the global picture seriously anyway, but in that picture, you wouldn't then have really solved the hour of time question with eternal inflation. If you just had, if you imagine that your initial to sit a patch is starting in some extremely special, excited state somehow, and that it then gives rise to, relaxes to being many, many states up here, then you still have the question, that why were those degrees of freedom that would later be spread out through all these different patches be in this extremely special initial state in the initial patch?
There also so, within a single horizon size region.
One could ask the question of all the degrees of freedom that exist on the final patch, why they happen to be in exactly the right state, so that when you traced it back, you got to that initial patch.
But since we can only measure something within a horizon, let's ask a question about that.
Ask what question about that?
Ask the question about what the dynamics predict for that. In that case, in this global picture, there's an attractor for those dynamics.
I'm going to go back to this. You have some final state, and when you trace those in this picture you're describing, where these are just sort of hidden degrees of freedom, they are still in a special state at early times. There's still a decrease in entropy as you go through this. You're still losing degrees of freedom, or at least losing degrees of freedom that are activated. So you still seem to have an error of time problem despite the attractive behavior along any given patch.
Yeah, I'm assuming some desiderative conditions, one of the SS3Cs.
Right, that's right. So in that sense, eternal inflation isn't doing what you maybe aspired it would do for you, which is solve the error of time problem.
Assuming those initial conditions.
It doesn't explain the initial, yeah.
Right, yeah. I'm not answering that question. Okay. I was specifically discussing this question of what the finance entropy means.
All right. Oh, so I think I that sounds like a plausible picture, if one is prepared to accept the global picture at all. But it doesn't seem to work with the error of time. That's I guess my thought.
I'm just going to define a standard comment, right? Which if there's any property X of the classical description of the universe, and from the quantum state, we calculate probabilities for it, right? In particular, that's true. For example, we calculate the probabilities for the backgrounds as well as for the fluctuations, and we calculate the probabilities for the arrow of time as measured by the growth of fluctuations. In very simple models, we get results such as the arrow of time keeps on going through recontraction, and if there's a bounce in the universe, then the arrow of time points in opposite directions on opposite sides. Whether the models are believable or not, as I think Matt would tell you, is quite a different question. They're simple compared to what the rest of you do, but at least there's a direction there to pursue to answer the question. So the standard comment is, I'll just say X is something, and then I won't have to take up so much time.
Yeah, as somebody who actually believes that the entropy found in De Sitter space is really a limit on the number of states, I just wanted to point out that there's another formula which tells you about what the entropy is of localized states in De Sitter space. And according to that formula, if we look at the history of the universe as we know it up till now, the entropy has been decreasing all the time. And will only start to increase again as things get swept out of the horizon, our galaxy collapses into a black hole, which Hawking radiates everything back into the De Sitter vacuum.
So what you're describing there is
entropy state is the De Sitter
is empty De Sitter space for in a given patch, that is. Yeah.
But we've been getting closer to that.
Sorry?
We've been getting closer to empty De Sitter space during the cosmological evolution.
We will get closer to it as things go out of our horizon.
They've been going out the whole time.
It just started a little while ago. If I think about the whole 10 billion years of cosmology that we normally talk about.
So, sorry, what is the
standard definition? The definition is the sum of the areas of the horizons. That goes down. Take De Sitter space with a static object in it so that we can really define what we mean by entropy. The entropy with a black hole is smaller than the entropy without a black hole.
De Sitter no hair there.
Because we've been creating more black holes inside the De Sitter.
But we're creating them out of matter that was already there.
Sorry?
But Tom, the presence of matter inside De Sitter reduces the horizon entropy. It doesn't matter if it's a black hole or... But the ordinary matter was already there, and then it formed black holes. That doesn't...
How can that be so? If you had some... the Earth and the Earth collapsed to a black hole.
Sorry?
If you had the Earth and then the Earth collapsed to a black hole, that would increase the entropy
of
the
Earth. That wouldn't change anything.
And you'd have thought that your argument seems to be that that's going to decrease the entropy of the horizon, the De Sitter horizon, because it's going to shrink in, but the De Sitter horizon doesn't care whether you have the Earth or the black hole at the same mass.
Understand the Sitter space and the Sitter entropy.
No, I think this is a good time to go on to Matt.
Okay, before I get to my question, I just have a comment for Neil. I'm not sure whether this satisfies all the criteria that you wanted it to satisfy, but I recently wrote down some solutions with Simeon Hellerman that are alpha prime exact solutions in string theory that represent expanding negative curvature universes. And of course, there are quantum corrections to those. And if you go back to the Big Bang, it goes out of control because quantum corrections get large. But at late times, as far as I know, that's a well-defined cosmological solution in string theory. They can. I mean, there's some energy density. For example, there's Casimir energy because there are compact cycles. It varies from place to place. You can add excitations to it, string modes, et cetera. As far as I know, that doesn't change the well-definedness of it. So I don't know if that meets your... No, it has a singularity in the past. Well, I don't think that there must have been a transition that can be described by classical geometry. I think probably there's some dynamics that one can understand that came before, but it doesn't have to be described as classical geometry.
So all you have is an out state?
Yes, right.
So how do you interpret this as a scattering amplitude?
You can't, or I don't know how in any case.
You weren't bothered by things with... You were trying to measure on things with singularity.
My talk was purely rhetorical, okay? Take it in that light. I was putting up there something better than what I'd seen and saying, look, this gives the wrong answer, and why can't... You know, that my talk was a challenge. That was the title of it. But so this is really interesting that you're saying the only example, as far as you know, finite density universe in string theory doesn't have an in state. It has only an out state.
Well, I'm not sure that's the only example. It's an example.
Okay.
But
but I asked if there were any others and didn't get any. Only an out state. So how do you interpret that? That's, I just want to ask. In state. So you think it does have an in and an out state?
I think so, yeah.
Well, you need to start working on cosmology.
I mean, I don't know enough about how you get inflatons in string theory, but I mean, is it really true that nobody has, say, some sort of inflaton in string theory that could do this behavior like this bounce universe I had? You just put a... I mean, normally, if you have an ordinary, you just have an m squared phi squared thing, you could just start phi some high up with a derivative small, and then you can have this thing that looks like the sitter, but it's got this inflaton going for it. Is it really true that there are no string theory solutions that look like that? Or I mean, I would have, I don't... Well, I mean, I would have certainly thought that there's tunneling, there's some small tunneling rates to other things, or if you wait very, very, very long time in the, you know, suppose there's a positive cosmological constant, you wait very long, it'll tunnel to something else. But I mean, that's non-perturbative. Is that really going to bother you? I mean, if you suppose you could produce this thing that has exponentially tiny rates of tunneling off to something entirely different until you go, you know, 10 to the 10 to the 40 years or something, wouldn't that be enough or not? But and do they really, I mean, presumably they really exist. Can the string theorists tell me, do they really exist? Can you have an inflaton that, you know, behaves something that you can actually have a bounce well away from the Planck length? I mean, do they really exist in string theory?
I think those things are, you know, there's obviously a lot. Why don't I make you answer, Rob?
I didn't quite understand the question, but I said yes.
Yeah, on that note, let me ask the question that I actually had intended to ask, which is, at this conference, there's been a lot of discussion of various speculative ideas, some more speculative than others, but various ideas, most of which are new and haven't really had a chance to be confronted with data. And it's completely natural and expectable that there would be a lot of disagreement over those ideas, and that people would have a wide range of opinions. But what I think is really striking is that the theory of inflation, slow-roll inflation, not necessarily eternal inflation, just slow-roll inflation, which has been around for approximately, 30 years? And since it was originally discovered, has been tested by multiple, you know, very expensive satellites. There's lots of data, probably hundreds, maybe thousands of cosmologists have worked on it. And yet still, today, there's what appears to be a very, very sharp disagreement among experts in the field on how good of an explanation slow-roll inflation is for the things it's supposed to explain, namely homogeneity and isotropy, the scale invariant spectrum of density perturbations, spatial flatness. And I think that's a remarkable situation, and I'm curious about it. So actually, I'd like to take a vote to start, which is how many, and let me phrase this question carefully, because I don't want there to be abstainers who can get out of it by not raising their hands. So I want people to raise their hands if they believe that slow-roll inflation is the best explanation that we have currently to explain homogeneity, isotropy, and, let's say, scale invariant spectrum of density perturbations. So how many people believe that inflation is the best explanation that we have now for those things? If you don't raise your hand, you're saying you don't believe that. Explain is the best explanation. It's the best theory. I mean, no, I don't want to get into what the definition of is. I think the question is pretty clear. How many people believe that that inflation is the best theory to account, explain, pick your favorite word, for these features? If you want me to, okay. Okay, let's start then with homogeneity and isotropy. How many people believe that slow-roll inflation is the best explanation for those features of our universe? And how many people believe it's the best explanation for the scale invariant spectrum of density perturbations? I don't really understand how you can believe the second and not the first.
I didn't hear. Oh, okay.
Okay. So I think it's probably true that the field as a whole, and this conference is selected maybe for people who don't necessarily buy that, but I think the field as a whole, you could correct me if you think I'm wrong, but I think there's a pretty strong consensus that inflation is the best theory for these things. And so this is a question directed at Paul or Neil or anyone else who wants to take it. Why is there still, after all this data, after all this time, after all this theory, such a sharp disagreement between you guys and others who've been thinking about this for so long and almost everybody else?
Not already. I think I tried to explain in my talk. It's because there was... At the early days, there was a gross misunderstanding about two fundamental issues, namely, what does inflation really predict? A misunderstanding about how inflation and quantum mechanics mix, and a gross misunderstanding about how likely it was, how strong an attractor it was, that the idea that any initial conditions would do and inflation would draw it to look like a universe which looks almost entirely like what we observe today. And that idea is what led to people working on the theory, led to the calculation of the fluctuations, led to the initial transients of inflation, what turned out to be the transients of inflation, the initial predictions of so-called predictions of inflation. There are now, the astrophysical community has taken over and has had fantastic success in testing. And the interesting historical fact is the astrophysicists are finding results which agree with those predictions of what I would call the pre-1983 version of inflation, our understanding at that time, where at the same time, theoretically, our understanding of inflation has evolved since 1983 in a completely different direction. And that's just a fascinating statement about the history of science and the history of this science. I don't know where it's going. We don't know yet what the end result of this story is going to be. But it could just be that we made a mistake, but in making a mistake, we actually predicted some things right, and we just it's just going to be a completely different, better idea that's going to end up reproducing those same conditions. And I'll also emphasize the condition, the number of remarkable things that have been achieved. I mean, there are things like scale invariance or near-scale invariance and homogeneity and isotropy. They're not some, you know, it's a kind of thing which you might imagine have happened by other entirely different means. Maybe something that was straight out of string theory without any need for inflation or ekphorosis or anything. They're not so remarkable. They don't have so many features and bumps and wiggles in them that we should, you know, we should imagine there's only one way of doing it. So it might just, I mean, so one possibility is just history, but at the moment now, there's a bunch of, you know, there's a large astrophysical community which looks at the data and says, oh, that agrees with what those guys wrote back in 1983. And so, and if I, you know, if I or others of us try to explain that there's these confusions, they say, yeah, that's just the theorist, that'll go away. And I've actually had this conversation many, many times with many astrophysicists. This is just your confusion, you know. Come back and tell us when you solved it, okay. But, so that's just a really, as far as I can tell, it's just an interesting historical feature.
Is there any data that would convince you that slow roll inflation is the right theory?
I want
the case. You can build the case. I would be just build the case. I think until we solve these other problems, I'm not sure I would agree with Neil.
I want to pose a question back to you. Why have string theorists who believe they're working out the fundamental theory of nature simply accepted that the only way they're going to get string theory to be compatible with the universe is to adopt this pre-1983 picture? Which is inflation, which has so much arbitrariness, doesn't give a single precise prediction. It's almost infinitely adjustable. Why have string theorists just bought this hook, line, and sinker, and said that the solution of quantum gravity will actually have nothing to do, nothing new to add, right, to the picture of inflation, which was based on quantum field theory. To me, it shows string theorists are somehow profoundly timid. which is
profoundly timid?
What? Profoundly timid.
Potential.
Aggressively timid.
and is that a sociological phenomenon in the field that people feel, they can't go outside the bounds of what's known about quantum field theory
I think if you look at the literature on this, you'll find an incredibly wild range of ideas about what the initial conditions for the universe were, what came, you know, before the Big Bang, if anything. There's all sorts of pretty crazy ideas out there that are coming from
the vast majority of papers are simply trying to embed inflation within string theory. Vast majority.
Well,
I think to some extent people have tried both things. You know, people have tried to use ADS-CFT to resolve the singularity and see if you get a bounce. Many of those people. You are some of those people.
Very few string theorists try and do that.
Well, That's right. And, but what's happened so far is that very competent people like Gary Horowitz, Thomas Hertog, yourself, other people, Ben Krapps, have tried to do that. And I think that no convincing evidence has emerged of a nice symmetric bounce. I think
let me
it's an open question, but what I'm saying is people have to some extent investigated these other wilder things, but there hasn't yet been any evidence, I don't think, that's been convincing that you can get the observation out of it. And
right, so yeah, hold it down here. I think Neil and Paul's question is a fair one. So I can only say, well, I'm a graduate student. You know, what do I know? But how do I make my decision when thinking about these kinds of things? Why am I inclined to think that inflation and maybe eternal inflation are the kind of framework that I want to see coming out of a fundamental theory, as opposed to something else? Well, what it seems to me is that there's a certain set of problems, the ones that Matt was mentioning in particular, which inflation seems to solve. I think it's hard to disagree that inflation does the three things that Matt says it does. Now, but you could also say that it raises sort of profound questions that Paul mentioned in his talk and that Neil talked a little bit about. I think Raphael emphasized the first day of the conference, these are, questions that come up whenever you do any kind of cosmology. But it seems that in eternal inflation, there's actually something of a framework where you could imagine answering these questions, where there are computations that people have done and sort of first sketches where it seems like, stuff seems to work out the way you might hope it would work out. Whereas with a lot of the other things, it seems like you sort of never even get past square one. You say the inflation models in string theory are ugly, and I would agree with that. But they work. Whereas these bouncing things just, it's not clear that they work at all. The string inflation ones have some crazy initial conditions that look ridiculous, but if you have those initial conditions, then if you believe effective field theory, they inflate. Is there any phase, please educate me, is there any, when you have these bounces, and I don't mean these 10 or 11 dimensional bounces, I mean the, four dimensional bounces, are there cases where you actually, all the way through the process, you know what the light fields are, you include all of the light fields, there aren't any other objects around which you didn't include, the energy density is low, the higher terms in the effective field theory expansion are suppressed, all of these things are true, and then you conclude that you know, and that's enough to tell you what happens in the bounce? I'm happy to, but I can start with an initial condition I understand, never mind where it came from, and then evolve it forwards, and then see if I can understand that evolution as I evolve it forwards. I don't want to take up enough time.
About
bounce which does not involve... Is this what you're asking? Is there a theory of the bounce which does not involve all the exotic higher states in M-theory? Definitely not. There is no such theory. So, well, okay, apart from, no, okay, so there, yeah. No, okay, what is puzzling me is why you are trying to resolve the cosmic singularity problem with the low energy effective theory. Well, try. Why aren't you trying? Seem to is the operable word.
I think there was something implicit in Adam's question, which is relevant to this, which was, why do we expect slow roll inflation, which is a theory that's supposed to explain certain features of the universe we observe, but not all of them, why do we expect slow roll inflation to answer this? Why does it have to account for its own initial conditions when no other theory that I know of in physics is expected to do that? It's not very clear.
No, sorry, I think that's...
I don't think that...
Too many people are talking, so I can get moderate.
I think that we've gotten to what's really an important point, and it's sort of the answer to the question that Matt muttered under his breath when he questioned why I asked for two votes. So there's a question of the initial conditions, how we got into the Bunch-Davies vacuum in an approximately homogeneous and isotropic universe. And then there's a question of whether that state accounts better for what we see in the sky than anything else. And despite a lot of trying, I'm really convinced it accounts better for the data than anything else that we see. I really believe that something like that has to, you know, with appropriate interpretation and possibly explanation of where it came from, has to be part of the answer to the data. There's an entirely separate question of whether inflation solves all the problems that it claimed to solve originally. And that, I think, is still open. And there's this question of initial conditions and why the entropy of the universe appeared to be so low and so on. I think those are two separate issues. And
so your point is that generating scale invariant density perturbations is...
Well, not just scale invariant, but the fact that
with the tilts,
into the horizon in
good.
Phase and all mm-hmm. of the details.
It's a dynamical mechanism. Right.
All of that stuff is there in the data. All of that is explained by conventional inflation. And if we throw away some of the claims about what it was supposed to do, then we have a theory that really works, and then we have a question of, well, how did we get into that state? Those are two separate questions.
It's the same reason that BBN is a better model than the model of just putting in the stuff, the right amount of helium. Okay, just because it explains what we see with a simple theory, starting from a simple assumption about initial conditions. Not anything deeper than that. It's exactly the same as BBN. BBN increases the entropy, okay, but it's a good theory. It's nothing at all different. Exactly.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, of course, you know, I have nothing to do with creating theories of inflation or anything. So, I don't have vested interest in it, but I suppose I've seen more literature about it than the ekpyrotic thing, and also maybe it has this very nice hydrogen atom thing where you have the harmonic, you know, this potential. Now, I don't know enough about string theory to know whether you can get it from that, but suppose you do say you have a model and that you could have something like an inflaton that could be in some state where it has some high value, so it has negligible time derivative. And that's a very special state, but of course, in my mind, really, I would weigh theories, I would give them high priorities if they're simple. So, I mean, of course, okay, uniform distribution over the Liouville measure is simple, so maybe I'd give that a high priority thing, but that doesn't work, so the likelihood's low. So I go to something else simple. So suppose we just start with some simple state and we have this bounce. I mean, I can sort of see what can happen, at least with slow roll inflation. You know, you have a bounce and it's not singular in both directions of time. So maybe I would like to know, is there some similar model in ekpyrotic model, the bouncing thing, where you really have some fairly definite equations as to what goes through the bounce, and you can, you know, you can have some simple initial condition, and it does all that. I mean, you know, maybe my bias is for inflation, but I do think, even though maybe I myself would not want to take the risk of working on ekpyrotic, I do think it's a very good thing if people do work on it as alternatives, because, you know, there's a danger that if inflation is successful, but there's also another theory that could also be successful is out there and nobody investigates it, you know, then it may be bad news because maybe we're going the wrong direction. So I greatly applaud the people with doing ekpyrotic. I'm just saying, for me personally, I would like to see a simple model that seems as simple as this bouncing universe, you know, with a simple 1/2 m squared phi squared plus tiny lambda potential. I mean, it seems a very simple model, even in the slow roll regime before I get off the internal inflation. And if I had something that simple from ekpyrotic and, you know, with sort of definite conditions as what happens in the bounce, then maybe I could understand it more and appreciate it more.
So I think the Neil or Paul could answer the question of whether there's such a model, and they'd say yes. And so there, that's not, so we're done with that. And then, hang on. And then we're going to go to the next phase of our session. And then before lunch, so we're going to finish that phase of the session. And then before lunch, everyone has to agree on the definition of simple. And then you get your food. So, but right now I'd like to open to questions. So this is a session where we have questions from people who have not asked a question so far. If you haven't. And the spirit is that you shouldn't worry if you've been quiet because you haven't thought as long about these problems as other people here, or if you feel less experienced in the field, or just felt like being quiet, or felt we were all being idiots and you didn't want to get involved. If you feel this is the right moment to ask a question, please do.
I'm a little confused about how you reconcile both pictures, the landscape and the eternal inflation. So are they complementary to each other, or are they completely different problems?
I'd say that they're logically independent, but insofar as you can imagine having a landscape of Minkowski vacua that didn't Minkowski and ADS vacua that didn't eternally inflate, and you could also imagine having just a simple lambda that did eternally inflate. But if you have both, as many people think they are, then they kind of get mixed up together because you eternally inflate at different points in the landscape and that helps populate the whole landscape. So they're logically distinct ideas, but they're kind of coming together in people's considerations if you believe that both exist.
I'll draw a picture.
Short, though, because...
Yeah. Thank you. which I think is very important in terms of addressing the initial conditions for our remote intuition. It started from somewhere, and that's a natural place to start from. So in that sense, yes, the landscape just will give us a free space of the initial conditions. But every one of those vacuum can be exactly the same as here. So you can get a good limitation here, and another one there.
Right. But I think this is what Coleman and DeLucia computed.
Yeah. Also, I think Adam did a good job of showing this.
So I think this is getting a little too focused, and we can do that independently. But let's see if there's another.
I think Adam did a good job in his talk of convincing us that it's always possible to make these transitions regardless of whether or not an instanton exists. So
it's definitely worth continuing this technical point later. And Andrew.
Yeah, so in what sense are the problems faced by inflation today similar to those faced by, say, quantum field theory maybe in the 1940s or 1950s?
I really hope they're very similar.
that's a good answer. Any others? Any other comments to that? Oh, question. Yeah.
Does that mean since without a quantum field theory, it has to be replaced by something else, and that would be your
Because string theory, and Earl, please correct me, but it is a classical theory. So one can place quantum field theory or quantum mechanics on that landscape of string theory rather than replace one for the other. And we had that discussion before, and I agree with Jim in his point of view. One of the reasons I think quantum mechanics or quantum field will survive is because if we have a scale in a theory, we know it's an effective theory. That scale tells us the range of validity. When it comes to quantum mechanics, we have an uncertainty principle, but no scale. So that could be a hint that it doesn't break down at some scale. When it comes to GR, we have the Planck scale. We know that scale tells us this is effective up to Planck scale, but no more. With quantum mechanics, we don't have that kind of a problem.
Can I make one more comment? So it's also, where did the question come from? The analogy is pretty strong in the following sense, is that slow roll inflation appears to give us the right answer, just as people discovered pretty early on that it gave you the right answer for G minus 2 to an astonishing and intriguing number of degrees of freedom. However, then people thought... People then thought a bit harder and realized that at sort of next order, it really the answer was infinity. So does that mean that the initial successes actually don't make sense since we don't understand actually the measure problem and being able to get any predictions out of it? Or does that mean, was that a false hint that we got these sort of correct things at the beginning? Or does it just mean we need to think harder about infinities? Now, the difference, I think, is that we didn't have to think actually for all that long after we figured out G minus 2 in order to make sense of the infinities, whereas we've been thinking for a long time about the infinities of eternal inflation without any great progress. So in that sense, I'm with Ben. I hope that it'll turn out to be like G minus 2. We know how to make sense of the infinities, and the correct answers it appears to be giving us at leading order turn out to be right, but there's no guarantee.
Wait, did you have a comment? No, go ahead and ask the question. Go for you.
Hi, I'm Godfrey Miller, just finished my fourth year in the PhD program at UPenn, and I'm very curious as to why very few of you just apply the axioms of probability theory. So you can't just construct a theory that maximizes the likelihood of observing exactly the data you'll observe and then declare victory and go home, right? The project of science is to infer reality from the data you observe. So here's how I would do it. Maybe I'm very naive, but given a well-defined hypothesis about the degrees of freedom in nature, and given a well-defined hypothesis about the equations of motion for those degrees of freedom, I would use my data to infer a probability distribution over the state of my system, and then I can just use my equations of motion to evolve backwards in time, and then say, given my hypothesis about the degrees of freedom of nature, given my probability distribution over, you know, possible states, I can infer what my theory says about the past history of the universe. But people don't do that. Why is that?
Because it gives completely wrong answers in every experiment ever performed by physicists or any other scientist.
Why do you say that?
Because if you do that, it tells you that the entropy should be increasing into the past.
I don't know about that. See, there's no...
If you want to explain why, when I push this coffee cup, it comes to rest, you have to take into account the fact that the laws of physics as we see them are not time symmetric, and that's presumably because of some reason that goes way back. But the point is, you can't take the state of things at this moment and evolve backwards and expect that to work the same way as evolving forwards. It's just not true.
So even in scalar field theory, with just one degree of freedom...
One degree of freedom, you might be okay, because the entropy...
So then why don't you do that in inflation, right? Like, your observation of the universe gives you some prior. You can use the symmetry of your ignorance to define a prior over the, you know, possible states in the theory and also over the parameters. You just evolve it backward, right?
Because post-dicting doesn't work like that. You can't post-dict the past.
It's just scientific inference. It's just axioms of probability theory.
That's a great example. So in BBN, at the time of BBN, the entropy of the universe was much lower than it is now. And if you ask, of the states of the universe today, how many of them go back to BBN the way we think it happened? The answer is an incredibly small fraction, from which, I think following your logic, one would conclude BBN is wrong.
But I don't think that was the question.
I mean, somewhere in the back of your mind, you have a hypothesis that we're probably a Boltzmann brain or something. Because, like, if I see a photon hit my eye, I assume from the get-go that I know the degrees of freedom, at least the local ones anyway. And I say, well, if the photon hit my eye, that means it was probably over there. Maybe it came from that star. So, I mean, we know what the low-energy degrees of freedom are. If you make a hypothesis about maybe just one more, like an inflaton, you know what the degree, you know what that degree of freedom is. You know how to work with it. Why don't you just evolve it?
You can do that going forward in time, but what you can't do is take the state of the universe today and try to use it to guess what the state of the universe in the past was by evolving laws of physics, including second law of thermodynamics. You can't do that. It gives completely wrong answers. You can't. I think this was Alan's point about the bouncing ball, right? You simply, it's just not true that going back in time is the same as going forward in time.
What I'm going to do, now I'm going to intervene and say, so continue the discussion. So I think that's a nice topic, and you guys can continue over barbecue. I've got two more questions, and then we're going to quit. So
think about some of the popular tools being used to address the problem. So a lot of the models seem to be based on some very fundamental principles like calculus, when we know that if you divide by zero, you get something that's undefined and infinity doesn't make sense to us. So I'm wondering if anybody thinks that maybe some of the tools being used are causing any problems, or if people think that perhaps development of new tools is perhaps the answer here.
Yeah, I mean, I would say we do need new tools, and these infinities that we get are, or even in other approaches, the singularity, we obviously need new tools. That's why I was harassing Rob, because, and, you know, to some extent, that's something I've worked on, but yes, I think we absolutely need new tools.
Okay, so I'm rather new to this, but I noticed that there was a lot of discussion about sort of new ideas, alternatives, rather than, as one might have expected on a discussion about eternal inflation and the measure problem, proposals for like definitive measures that would solve all our problems and maybe lead us to some ultimate theory of quantum gravity. So I was kind of wondering, it seems like this might have originally started out as kind of, you know, when people first saw this problem, they might have expected maybe we'll find a measure which kind of works and leads us in the right direction. And I was wondering to what extent people who study this seriously think that this might still be an option as opposed to having to look in new directions.
So I think that's a great question. And I've actually sort of felt at this meeting a sort of new consensus developed that I don't think was there before, which is that this project of trying to write down a global cutoff and just, you know, you're going to get the right global cutoff, I haven't really heard anyone say at this meeting that we're just going to write down a sort of semi-classical global cutoff and that's going to tell us what the answer is and then we'll all realize it's right. That sort of project is not going anywhere. And maybe, Alan, you have something to say about that or some other people, Mike, who's worked on these global cutoffs, but I would say that that's a great question. At the beginning, there was that aspiration.
So what, Alan, if you come and then we're going to get barbecue.
I guess I would phrase things slightly differently because I think that project has gone somewhere. And I think most of us who work on measures at this meeting have a pretty good agreement among ourselves, at least, of what kinds of global measures work and what kinds don't work. What I think none of us have ever claimed was that that was going to be the final story. And I think we still don't believe it's the final story. So I think, you know, because we've more or less, at least locally at least, achieved kind of a consensus what kinds of measures work, the emphasis of what people talked about at this meeting is how to go further, how to look for some fundamental explanation where everything is pretty much up in the air still.
Okay, that wasn't phrasing it differently. That was disagreeing with me, but I take your.
So I would like, this was a lot of fun. I would like to thank everyone here for participating.